Protests have continued throughout the Arab world since early January. In some countries, the leaders have been overthrown after having spent decades in power. In others, things have settled into violent stalemates. And in many of them, sectarian tensions have played a role. Joining me now for an update on the region and a look at those sectarian tensions is Blake Hounshell, Managing Editor of Foreign Policy. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show for today's first Backstory segment. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Perhaps the most violent crackdown on protesters has been in Syria, where it's estimated that more than 1,100 protesters have been killed, including around 60 so far this week, and more than 10,000 have been detained since the protests began. Early on, President Bashar al-Assad had made statements about making his government more humble. Has that conciliatory tone from the government evaporated?
Pretty much. The Assad has, periodically come out with, sort of gestures to the protesters. Yesterday, he announced some kind of amnesty, and if you read the fine print, it doesn't really apply to the protesters at all. So I don't think anyone takes his, reform efforts seriously anymore, least of all the Syrian people.
And there have been large protests in cities throughout the country. Again, there were last Friday. I assume we'll see more tomorrow. So the protesters have remained defiant during all of this violence, including the mutilation of a 13-year-old boy?
It's really incredible. Very few people, I think, expected Syrians to rise up the way they did. It's such a repressive country, probably one of the most repressive governments in the world. And the government is so brutal and has a history of putting down any kind of protest very violently. So it's just amazing that people are daring to go out at all. And I think it, speaks to how desperate people are for some kind of better life. This story about this 13-year-old boy is just heartbreaking. He was brutally tortured. There's a video on YouTube. People can go watch it, although, it's not something I advise you to do before you go to sleep. It's really horrifying. But that has actually, I think, galvanized and given a second wind to the protesters where they seem to be losing some steam in the last few weeks.
But the protests are all limited to certain parts of the country. Aren't there many people in Syria who see the government as being stabilizing? And also, in the past, President Bashar al-Assad has protected religious minorities. And so some of the minorities have been supporting the government because they fear what would happen under another government.
Well, that's exactly right. The government itself is kind of a coalition of Alawites. Bashar al-Assad himself is an Alawite, which is a kind of basically a Shiite sect of Islam. But the majority of the country are Sunnis. And the regime has, based its legitimacy on secularism. And what that means in a place like Syria is that, Christian minorities feel protected, they feel safe because they don't have a kind of a tyranny of the majority, and that's what they fear in a changing Syria. They look at what happened to Christians in Iraq, and they're terrified. And if you look at some of the rhetoric coming from some of the protesters, I think they have good reason to be worried.
More than 300 Syrian opposition activists are meeting in Turkey this week, where they're hoping to draft a joint declaration to help support the uprising. Have the protests in Syria been well organized in the face of the continued crackdowns? And what is Turkey's role in all of this?
Well, the amazing thing about the protests in Syria is that they've been, almost completely spontaneous. Any organization that we know of has really come after the fact. There were attempts to organize demonstrations in the wake of what happened in Tunisia, and they really didn't go anywhere. There was a Facebook call for a protest in Damascus, and nobody showed up. But what happened is a bunch of teenagers, kids really, in Dera, which is this southern town, wrote some anti-regime graffiti, and they were arrested. And that really sort of lit the spark of broader protests, and the protests have spread from there. But the attempts to organize some kind of, transitional government or representatives of the uprising have all come after the fact, and that's why I think it's you know been so difficult to explain to the outside world, you know, what do Syrians want, what do these protesters want, and what do they see as the future of Syria?
Of course, that's been made even more difficult by the fact that reporters were kicked out of the country, and its borders were closed for a while in late April. Has the condemnation by the international community had much of an impact? It is clear that a leader can withstand an awful lot of pressure and still remain in power, as we've seen in the case of Gaddafi.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dilemma for the outside world is nobody really knows what would replace Bashar al-Assad. And, you know, there's a lot of worry about the kind of sectarian violence that we saw in Iraq. You know, nobody really likes Bashar al-Assad. There was some sense early on in his tenure that he was going to be a reformer, and he did enact some economic reforms. But generally speaking, you know, he's been sort of more of the same. And I think the dilemma for, you know, the United States, the United Nations, or people trying to manage the situation from outside is, you know, if you get rid of Bashar al-Assad, is there going to be something better in his place or not?
My guest is Blake Hounshell, managing editor of Foreign Policy. We're talking about sectarian tensions and the protests in the Arab world for today's first backstory segment on the London Globe Page Show here on WNYC, WNYC.org. Martial law was repealed in Bahrain yesterday. Is that likely to have much of an effect on the situation on the ground as protesters continue to face off with the police?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm kind of a cynical observer of Bahrain, and I think it's pretty clear that the state of emergency was lifted because the government of Bahrain wants to get the Formula One race back, which was suspended in the wake of the protests there, not because they're really interested in, you know, serious democratic reforms. You know, we saw what happened yesterday. There were, you know, scattered protests that were violently dispersed. There were activists arrested, brought in for questioning. There are still members of parliament who have been detained, human rights activists. The government's call for dialogue, I think, doesn't have a lot of credibility right now.
Well, King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa did call for a national dialogue to be held in July, but that's like striking a conciliatory tone at the same time that you're killing people in a crackdown and closing mosques, I gather.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a strategy of wanting to present yourself as, you know, open to change, while doing everything you can under the table to make sure that people will reject that call for dialogue. The opposition in Bahrain has really been radicalized over the last few months by what's happened, and that's made it a lot harder, you know, to envision any kind of process where, you know, people come to the table and have a kind of constructive conversation. I think it's so nasty in Bahrain, and there have been, so many really horrible human rights abuses, and it's kind of hard to imagine how these people learn to live with each other again.
Well, it seems like an insoluble situation. You have a majority Shiite country that's been ruled by Sunnis for years, and the Sunnis do not seem to want to give in to any of the Shiite demands. Did Saudi Arabia's decision back in March to send troops to help the Bahraini government restore order solidify the notion of this being a Sunni versus Shiite conflict?
You know, it didn't have to start that way. I mean, certainly the majority of the protesters from the very beginning were Shiite, but that's, I think, a function of, you know, who's really disenfranchised in that country. But I think the government has really pursued a sectarian strategy and tried to, you know, mobilize its base of support by painting all opposition as Shiite motivated, tied to Iran. And certainly the Saudis, you know, see things through that lens. And I think not just because they They support the monarchy in Bahrain, and they don't want to see any other Gulf monarchs fall. They don't like that principle. But they also, I think, the leadership of Saudi Arabia really does believe this is all just an Iranian plot. And you hear that a lot throughout the Gulf, just from ordinary people. It's unfortunate, but that's the way a lot of people see things.
What about where you are in Doha, Qatar?
Well, you know, Qatar's a pretty interesting situation because Qatar has probably the best relations with Iran of any country in the region. They share a huge natural gas field, and people like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad come to Doha regularly. But at the same time, you've got the same kind of population that doesn't really look too kindly on Shiites in the region. So the government is doing one thing, but I think the public in Qatar is probably solidly behind the regime in Bahrain.
In Egypt, there have been renewed tensions after at least two Coptic Christian churches in Cairo were burned last month. 12 people died in clashes between Christians and Muslims. Are the concerns that the Copts could be excluded from a post-Mubarak government? Because the Copts do make up 10% of the Egyptian population.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly that's something that Copts fear, and Copts are terrified of the Muslim Brotherhood and even, you know, more radical groups that have really come out of the woodwork after the fall of Hosni Mubarak. There have been they're called Salafists, these radical fundamentalists who want to go back to the, you know, 7th century, basically. And a lot of them view Christians as, you know, infidels. And these people are really, they're free to voice their views now and organize in a way that they weren't under the Mubarak regime. And that's got a lot of people worried. And I don't think anyone has a good answer for how do you deal with these people. A lot of the protesters in Cairo complain that the military government has been cracking down on liberals and been a lot slower to deal with these radical extremists, and it's really a scary situation.
President Obama is sending his counterterrorism advisor to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to discuss events in Yemen, where there was heavy fighting yesterday, particularly in Sana'a. One diplomatic official there was quoted in the New York Times as saying that this is the worst fighting since the two-month civil war in 1994. Are there fears that the country is moving closer to another civil war?
You know, we tend to play these word games with these situations in these countries. You know, when does it become a civil war? I don't know the answer, how you define civil war, but it's clear that it's really bloody and nasty. Al-Qaeda has supposedly taken over one or two towns while the government has been focusing on protesters and dealing with, you know, tribal opponents of President Saleh. So there are a lot of different potential conflicts in Yemen that could break out. It will look maybe less like a, you know, traditional civil war with two battle lines, but it'll be more like Somalia, where you just kind of have a lot of chaotic violence and a kind of a war of all against all, which is so sad because the amazing thing about Yemen, which is a country that, you know, is heavily armed, the one statistic that you hear is that there are three times as many guns as people. But the protests in Yemen were overwhelmingly peaceful. There were fewer casualties in Yemen than any of these other countries until recently. And I think, you know, President Saleh has really played his hand cynically and tried to stir up violence in order to stay in power.
Well, a few days ago in the city of Taiz, government officials and plainclothes police officers fired on peaceful protesters and killed dozens. Has that deterred protesters from returning to the streets?
Yeah, well, we heard that protesters are planning to, you know, march on those central areas en masse tomorrow, which could get bloody. It was there were some horrible reports coming out of Taiz. Apparently, one of the main areas where the protesters were was sort of down the hill, and the government forces were rolling burning tires down the hill into tents. And We're told that one tent full of handicapped people burned, and there are people that were burned alive inside. It was just horrible.
And we're talking about one of the poorest countries in the region, so the violence has to have just exacerbated the situation. The protests have gone on now in some of these countries for months. Is there a sense that any of them are making progress?
Well, I think, you know, the one bright spot now, although it's hard to believe it, is Libya. I think there's a lot of impatience in Western capitals about the NATO mission in Libya, but we're finally starting to see, you know, some progress, new defections from the regime. You know, the city of Misrata, which was besieged for a long time and was really kind of Libya's Stalingrad, has been completely cleared. And in the western mountains, the rebels seem to be making some gains. So I'm hopeful that Gaddafi's days are numbered, and that might be, you know, one positive outcome of what's been, you know, a pretty brutal last few months.
But all these others may linger for a while.
I mean, it's hard to imagine Bashar al-Assad being ousted anytime soon. He doesn't have any incentive to leave power, and the people around him are going to fight to the death because they worry that in a Sunni-run country, they're going to lose out big time. And it's not like a situation like Tunisia and Egypt where you had a professional military, relatively professional, detached from the ruling regime. The military in Syria is very much part of the system, and that's what I think makes it so hard to get rid of a guy like Bashar al-Assad.
Blake, thank you so much for talking with us. I've been talking with Blake Hounshell, managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine from Doha, Qatar, as part of our first backstory segment, a look at sectarian tensions and the protests in the Arab world. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.